OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
Number one cornerstone on this monument is Stephen Staunton. And I would wager that by the age of 21, he probably had a CV like on par with anything we've seen in Irish sport.
Others are controversial.
Michael Murphy might actually be debated as whether he deserved to be there any more than some of the players from 1992.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
Galway is so diverse. I think Galway people can feel fairly proud of them too.
And catch the live decision making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7:30 AM on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Now, you're very welcome back. I have to tell you, loads of great reaction when we told you this next man was coming on. People still have a huge amount of affection for the one and only Paddy Bonner. We know about the Irish story, 80 caps, Euro 88, two World Cups, part of Mick McCarthy's coaching staff, technical director with the FAI for a time, technical advisor with UEFA now as well. And then the Celtic career is quite extraordinary as well. 642 appearances for Celtic across 17 years, four league titles in 1981, 1982, 1986, 1988. He says it's three Scottish Cups because he missed the final, but it's actually four, so don't mind him. In 85, 89, 95 are his three, and then a League Cup as well in 83 and 87. And we're thrilled he's with us. You're live on the line. Paddy Bonner, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You got me on a really good day because it's raining outside, and I'm stuck here in the house today. So it's a perfect opportunity to talk to everybody in Ireland and talk to yourself, Joe. So delighted to be on. I've got my cup of tea here.
Perfect.
With me, I think. So we're on for the next hour, I think.
Yes, I have my cup of tea here as well. So that is very good much man. The plan. Where is home? Glasgow, I presume.
That's a big question because that's the argument myself and my wife have all the time. Even the other day, I says, oh, I'd love to be home. And she says, home's Glasgow. And I says, well, let's face it, if you're a Donegal man, home's always Donegal. But here's, so I've got two homes, let's put it that way, to be diplomatic. I've been here in Glasgow now for 42 years. So it's quite a huge time. I went to Reading for that little spell with Tommy Burns. But we kept our house here, so we were always going to come back here. My wife's from Glasgow, kids were born here, grandchild, but Donegal always drags you there, you know, and we love going over. I miss it at the moment with the close down. It's the bit that I do miss.
I was on YouTube last night and I was watching a piece you did for Donegal TV a couple of years ago, and you showed us your house, and it's just picture perfect. I mean, I know it was a guest house for a time, and it's in just the Donegal you might imagine from afar in your mind, just beautiful landscape and right on the shore as well, and just looked like an idyllic place to grow up. You might tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, our house, my mum and dad, there was 10 of us in the house, my grandmother, my mum and dad, and there were seven children, Dennis, my twin brother, and five sisters. So we were probably a little bit spoiled in one way that we had all the girls in the house looking after us, but we did all the hard work outside. But we were right on the sea, more or less, looking out onto Ardmore Island and next up America. And when you kind of sort of almost drive down off the main road, it's about a mile down, and then eventually just come over the top of the hill, and there's the house. And it was, you're right, it was a bed and breakfast for a period when we were young. Mum and Dad, it was actually built for a bed and breakfast years ago with my dad's family. And then a few things happened and they stopped. But then later years, my mum and dad started it off again when we were teenagers. And it was wonderful because we had so many different people coming to the house from not so much different nationalities, you know, foreigners, but we had Scottish people, we had a lot of people from Northern Ireland, people from Dublin, Catholic, Protestant, didn't really matter. And we probably became very good friends with many of them over the years. My dad was a great storyteller, and they used to come back even when we stopped at the bed and breakfast. They used to come back and visit a lot. And it was an idyllic upbringing, I must say. We worked hard down there because you had to. There wasn't what they have now, so you had to get out into the country and into the fields and be self-sustainable. And myself and Dennis, even though we were young boys and loved our sport, loved our football, we worked hard, and But it was, when I look back in it now as a man of nearly 60, not quite there, but nearly 60, and reflect back on it, I think it was probably as good an upbringing as anybody could have, you know, that sort of put some key traits into us that probably are there to this day, you know, a bit of resilience, hard work didn't go amiss, but kind of honesty. Family was hugely important to us all, and we're all very close. We lost our dad when I was 22, 23, and that was probably the biggest regret of all, is that he wasn't around to probably enjoy the times that I had in football. And even Dennis, when he played League of Ireland football, he wasn't quite around. And Mum had to then step in. She died about 4 or 5 years ago. She lived right into her 90s, which was fantastic. Wow. But family was a big, big thing to us all.
How did your father pass, Paddy?
He had a heart attack one day. He was he was working down in the garage and went up to bed in the afternoon for a little nap, and suddenly he was gone. And he was kind of suffering a little bit. He had a few other ailments, but it was a huge, huge shock. I was in Glasgow. I was 22 years old and got the word. And you know, it kind of, I suppose the other problem, what it was, I was kind of in the middle of the league at the time. I was in the first team. We were playing Hibs on. Funnily enough, the incredible thing was that we were playing Hibs on the following Saturday, and I went home and I missed the game. And it was the only game that year, for and probably in a number of years, that the game was actually shown on RTE, because there was a strike or something on, and right. They showed Celtic versus Hibs, and we sat in after the funeral and said to the old one, listen, well, we watched the game. She says, of course, watch the game, because that's what he would be doing right now. So we sat in. But, you know, at 22, when you lose your dad, and yeah. I didn't get a lot of time to probably mourn him. And I had to leave family, because I had to leave probably the day after the funeral and go back, because we were playing a European game the following Wednesday. I think we played Sporting Lisbon, if I can remember rightly, and I had to get back into the team. So I didn't have a lot of time, and it's probably later on then when you reflect back on it that he was a mighty man, and he loved the sport. He didn't play sport, but he loved sport. And one of the other things I remember as growing up, he kind of introduced us a little bit to boxing on radio. Can you remember those? You wouldn't remember those days, Joe.
But no, but I know my grandfather was like probably a lot of that generation adored whatever the magic of Muhammad Ali that he could bring to the radio.
Yeah, and I remember listening with my dad and Dennis and that, and watching listening to the radio and Muhammad Ali fights on. And then the World Cup came along in 1970, and we were 10 years old. We had our TV probably 2 years earlier. And suddenly we were watching watching the World Cup in 1970. It was probably my first real memory of you know, football, and really got into us. My dad always said that he played with Sligo Rovers. But that definitely wasn't the case. But he always said, I play with Sligo Rovers, because he used to work up around there too at times when he was a young man. And Dennis eventually went on to play for Sligo Rovers, which was incredible. But no, he loved it. He loved the sport. And he would travel then with us when we played with Cage Rovers, a local team. Got into the team. We were 16, 17 when we got into a youth team, and then suddenly very quickly got into the first team, played Donegal League amateur football. And he would travel with a team, himself and another guy up the road who was the father of a few of the other boys, played in the same. And they would travel, and they would travel all over Donegal with us. So we absolutely loved it. That's my regret, that he wasn't around just to live those days. I can imagine him going to the World Cup, or I can imagine him in the players' lounge over at Celtic Park when it was in my heyday, you know. But anyway. Not to worry, he was looking down on us.
Yeah, I'm sure. Do you have that belief? Do you have a faith?
Yeah, I always had a faith, still had a faith. I actually listened into Mass today, believe it or not, from Burton Port on live. It's something that probably when I was younger, I had a lot more faith, maybe only because I kind of used it a little bit in a selfish way, because, you know, I prayed a bit and went to Mass and did all the things that you probably did. And then when pressure came on, I kind of threw myself into it a little bit as something that would give me a little bit of help. Yeah. And probably in a selfish way. And that maybe as I got older then and the pressure came off a little bit more, I probably wasn't as religious, but still I love going to Mass. I love going there just to think and reflect on things, and that's probably, I wouldn't push it down anybody's throat, that's for sure. But certainly for me it was a solace.
I want to come back to the youth and Donegal in a moment, but you're seeing as we've gone off on this tangent. Both my parents are still alive, thankfully, and touch wood, for years to come as well. On special days when people have lost a parent, be it their wedding day or other days, it does seem like invariably it's tinged with a certain sadness, a certain regret. You know, these would have been great moments to share. When you save Tomofte's penalty, when you do great things across your career, is it there? Is it in your mind on those days?
Not really. I think he's always, when you go back home you know, you're going to... I'll tell you what I think of parents. And I know that a lot of people have lost family over this last while. And it's been a tough time, and they can't grieve the way that we normally grieve, and so on. But I think when you lose a mum or a dad, and you can almost have to grow up. You know, losing a dad at that point in time, both myself and Dennis probably had to grow up a little bit. We were the men in the family. The rest were girls and my mum and so on. And that kind of hits you. And every time you do go home, probably you remember. As time goes on, listen, you don't think of them as much as you did when you were young. But definitely during the period of the good times, I just wished he was around. My mum loved it. And she was very stable in the house. You know, it was incredible during the great period after 1990, especially. There were so many people that came to our house, called to our house. People from all over the world, by the way. And they would come down, and my mum always welcomed them, and she always, you know, chatted to them, and maybe even give them a cup of tea if she had time, and she just felt that that's the way probably our family was, you know, welcome people into the house and that, she enjoyed the good times too. Yeah,
it sounds like a beautiful childhood. When you say your father was a great storyteller, so maybe there are guests in the house or maybe not, I'm having visions of you all sitting around, the fire is on, people have a cup of tea, and he's telling stories. What kind of stories did he tell?
Well, you know, listen, he would make up a lot of stories, to be perfectly honest.
His time with Sligo Rovers.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, he just had a way with him to capture that way. I suppose a lot of people in those days, during that time, that was their probably hobby to a point, yeah. You know, and would gather. And there's a great word down in Donegal called garnial. I don't know if it's throughout the country in those days, but people went to each other's house and visited and sat down and talked and that. And when they didn't have TVs and all of that, and it sounds a bit mad going back to those days, but it's not that long ago, you know, it's 50 years ago, and times have changed dramatically. But that's kind of the way we were brought up. He would be in the house and people would come, and then suddenly he would be talking, and people loved it, you know. But he just had a natural ability. I don't have that ability. Dennis is much better at it than I. He makes up a few stories along the way too himself. I have a sister, Kathy, who's a great storyteller. If she went on holiday, she would come back with about 20 different stories, and she's got a great way with her. So I think they followed my dad, yeah.
Aside from sport and before soccer took you on this amazing journey and to Glasgow, what do you suspect you would have done if it hadn't intervened and taken you away? Would you have stayed in Donegal?
Well, I had planned. I was doing my leaving cert when probably I went to Celtic on trial and then got into the Irish youth team. And I had my heart and mind made up that I was going to go down to Thomond College at the time, as Limerick University, but Thomond at that time to do PE. I also went down to the Polytech, I think, in Belfast at the time. I actually went down and did an interview down there to go in there, whether that was where I was going to end up or go back down to Thomond. But that was the kind of direction. I was interested in sport and so on, but I kind of knew that I needed to probably move away to do that. I don't think I would have probably stayed in Donegal. Just naturally, you would have to go to university, as most people do. And that, so probably would have been on. I love sport, and I had a real kind of dream that I would be a professional player someday. Didn't really think that it would happen. I didn't think that I would ever get the opportunity. I went over to Leicester City on trial. There was a scout in Derry called Jim O'Hay, lovely man, And I went in for trials one day, and then he asked me to go over to Leicester City. And I went over and back for a couple of years, probably about a year and a half. John O'Neill, if you remember John O'Neill, he was over at the time. He was in Loughborough University, and we all stayed in a hostel together. And it was great. And, you know, Leicester City at that time had, you know, Keith Weller and Mark Burchill up front. I'm trying to think. It was who Peter Shilton had gone and that. But Mark Wallington was the goalkeeper, actually. But it was great. It was giving me a little taste for what maybe professional football was like. But it didn't happen for me. They didn't sign me. And then I stepped away from that and went back to school, back thinking that get stuck in now, get a leaving cert, and then get off to Tomé College. And then the Celtic thing came about.
Yeah. Sean Fallon's obviously a fairly famous name in Irish football, and he made the connections. The image, and I know you've talked about this, so we don't have to dwell on it, but just for people who don't know, the image which always jumps to mind is you as a teenager, 17, 18, 19 years of age, and your parents in the Ballyrain Hotel in Letterkenny, yeah, waiting for Jock Steen, and in he comes through the door. This is about 2, 3, 4 weeks before he will leave Celtic. You're his last ever signing. I mean, it's amazing he came over to bother and sign a teenager, but Jock Steen walking in the door and your two parents sat there, that must have been a hell of a moment.
Yeah, you know, Sean was the instigator of it. He was the chief scout, and, you know, over the years then I became great friends with Sean and his family. But Jock had decided for some reason that he knew, he must have known that he was leaving the club, because he had left 2 weeks after it. And for him to even bother or give up his time to come over to Donegal to sign Paddy Bonner, you know, who was an 18-year-old boy, I don't know really, he wasn't getting any money for it or anything of that nature. And for him to do that, considering that he was leaving the club, you know, was a big break, because probably other people wouldn't have done it. So I think back in that moment as a turning moment in my life. But it was an incredible feeling, because Jock walked in, and Fran Fields, of course, his big buddy, Finn Harps, was behind him. But as he walked into the room, you know, I got the phone call to say that he was coming over. We travelled from home out with an hour, out to Letterkenny, out to the Ballyrain Hotel, my mum and dad. Actually, the manager of Cage Rovers and a couple of the other guys, they were in a different room for some reason at that moment in time. But Jock came in, and I can't even remember too much about the conversation. All I remember was signing. Offered me the contract, and it was £70 a week, something of that nature, and £1,000 sending off on fee. And he did say to me, he says, look after your parents with that £1,000. So I kind of gave him it to mum and dad, about half of it, and I took half of it with myself to buy myself a new suit and so on. And that was it. And then I continued at school for another couple of months, actually. That was May, early May, and then continued until we finished the exams, and off I went in July. But Jock Steen, you know, he's historic in Celtic's history. Won the European Cup, had huge players, fantastic players under him. And for him to just even think about coming over to sign me, and him, me being his last signing, probably has gone down in a bit of history books also. Yeah. So I'm very proud of that, and I thank him very much for even thinking about that.
Your idyllic upbringing in some ways, and very family-centric and almost self-sufficient and living off the land, and even just, you know, people who grow up by the sea miss it massively when they move away. To go from all of that to the hustle and bustle of Glasgow and professional environment, what was that move like for you? I mean, where do you stay? How do you settle in? The first few months there, are they rocky, or do you love it from the start?
No, I was lucky. Listen, I was very lucky that I had two aunts and uncles over there. I decided to stay with my dad's aunt my dad's sister, my aunt, and her husband, and they had an older a son living in the house with them, and that. So I just stepped into that. I think my mum and dad was happy that I was going into that environment also, that there was somebody there to look after me. But it was huge going from a country background into a city background, and having to get used to catching the right bus and going into the city. And just I remember first couple of periods, it was Sean Fallon that used to pick me up and drop me in to get me used to getting into Celtic Park, and he brought me straight into the first team dressing room. First day I went in there, and there was Danny McGrain and Tommy Burns and Roy Aiken and Pat Stanton and all of these, Paul Walsh, all of these famous Celtic players. And he brought me straight in to introduce me to them. And there was only the reserves and the first team at that point in time. There was no youth set up or anything. The Celtic Boys Club was sort of a different entity. You were training with the first team from day one. It wasn't a case where you were off in an academy or somewhere else training. So you were straight into it. So that helped. But I was homesick, definitely. At that time, there was no mobile phones. We didn't have a phone in the house, so I had to arrange times to phone my dad and from a neighbor's house. And all of that, letters was a big thing for me, writing to different people and them writing back to me. But I admit it now to this day that some nights I did cry myself to sleep, and it sounds a bit stupid, but
no, not at all.
You know, I was 18 years old, and I was away from Dennis, and I was away from family and all that in the city, and so it was really, really homesick. I think if I wasn't an academy set up, I think now about the young boys that's gone over at, you know, 15, 16 years old, and it must be really, really tough for them. And I know technology helps. And all of that, and parents are over and back, and that, even then, you know, there was no flight, you had to travel on the boat, all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't easy for family to come over and back. I would have found it tough if I wasn't in with the first team and training with the first team almost on a daily basis from day one. I think I would have found it really tough.
Yeah, it seems like it was just the way it was for your generation going over. We'd Ronnie Whelan on about a month ago, and he said he was generally okay except for Sundays, because Sundays at home in Finglas, that was when everybody was around. It was Sunday dinner, family, neighbours. He said he used to sit in his digs in Liverpool on a Sunday and turn up the rebel music loud and cry. And it's terribly sad, you know, but I guess it was not much way around it back then.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. Ronnie actually was over in trial. You know, I was in the first team just about, Ronnie's a year or so, maybe younger than me. And he came over in trial when he was probably going to Liverpool. He probably went to a few other clubs, but he came over for a week over in trial to Celtic also. They were desperate to try to sign him, but I think he had mainly up at Liverpool. And I think he was right about Sunday. Sunday was always a difficult day, you know, because you were wearing in the club and that. But I was very lucky that I had my aunts and your uncles there, because I could go and visit them up and down, and we played cards and we did all the things that you might have did when you were back home too. So that was a help.
If you were an outfield player now, I would probably ask you a question about the step up, as in, you know, the play was faster, players more intelligent, better touch, better skill, better vision, and you're dealing with all of that. A goalkeeper, I'm not sure what the question is. Like, I presume they kick the ball a bit harder, a bit more accurate. How much coaching had you had? Were you pretty agricultural? And obviously you've got this great physique, you're made for it. But in terms of Packy Bonner, the goalkeeper, and improving or being able to hack it with these top players, give us your experience of that.
Yeah, I think I was lucky again a little bit, coming from where I came from, and I played Gaelic football too. Along with playing with Cage Rovers, I played with Ross's Rovers, and then got into Donegal, actually got into Donegal senior team. I played about 4 or 5 games in the league alongside Dennis. Dennis played also.
Did you? I didn't realise that. The Donegal seniors.
Yeah, we played minor and then we played senior. Shannon Donald was the manager at the time, and he brought the two of us in. And I played, started off corner forward. My first game for Donegal was against Leitrim down in Donald Park in Letterkenny. And we played Leitrim in it was a league game. We were down Division 3 at the time, which probably that's maybe one of the reasons why we got our opportunity. There was actually a lad that broke his ankle that day for Leitrim. There was snow on the pitch, I always remember it, and he turned his ankle and broke his ankle. But anyway, I got into the team. Then I moved into midfield. I could catch the ball. I was one of those guys who could go up and catch the ball, no problem. And among people loved it. Yeah. But I couldn't do much more with it. I had to give it to somebody else to go and do something with it. But getting in, and that time it was Martin Carney, who was living in Donegal at the time. There was Seamus Boner. There was Brendan Dunleavy. There was Martin Griffin. There was, you know, all of Noel McCall was in goals, who was a Dunlow man. So getting in there, that was brilliant. So I was a big, strong boy, very thin, immature, probably going over straight out of Caju. And within 6 months, I got into the first team. But there was no coaching as such. I was lucky that Frank Connor was there. Frank Connor used to play and goal. He was in charge of reserves. He actually played with Derry City many years ago also, and that. So, but Frank was kind of the coach, but it was probably not an out-and-out goalkeeper coach. He was more an outfield coach, but he almost took care of us a little bit. So he developed certain things. He had to improve my strength and all of those type of things. Stepping up, the one thing that Big Billy McNeil said to me, who was the manager at that point then when Jock left, said that the game is faster. They'll hit the ball quicker. You've got to be on your toes. You can't. So all of that stuck in my mind a little bit. But I was almost self-developed. Peter Latchford was the other goalkeeper, and the two of us used to train together. And we kind of just developed ourselves. There was no. If I look back on it, and I wish I had some of the sports science and some of the stuff that's going on now, even the analysis, you know, looking at the faults and all that. I look back at some of the games. Some of the games are on just now on BBC over here in Scotland, and I work for BBC, and sometimes I cringe at some of the things that I was doing as a player. One of the faults I had, actually, and maybe it was down to maybe playing Gaelic football a little bit, I used to jump early. When I went into maybe two or three people and I went in midfield, I would kind of very much go under the ball and jump early and try and catch it before anybody else was near me. And in soccer terms, that was a problem, because if a cross was coming in, I had this habit of catching the ball almost behind my head, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that's not the thing you do in soccer. And I lost a few goals. I had to adapt then and change that. So trying to catch the ball in front more mm-hmm. So. So there was a few things that I had to change and learn. But I had to work it out myself. And you work it out by playing. And I had to work it out by making mistakes, but also thinking about them. And I suppose that's one of the great things I had, was that I could self-analyze. Mm. And maybe something that maybe nowadays people tell people what's wrong, rather than working it out for themselves.
So in effect, I'm suspecting you spent a lot of time thinking about your technique and thinking about certain types of shots and what's the best way for me to stop them. You didn't have someone telling you which hand to lead with or whether to catch or punch.
No, everything really was self-developed. And also, when I went into coaching later, and the initial goalkeeping coaching, for example, which was very much introductory level, I could break everything down. You know, I knew what foot that you should be jumping off to go left or go right. Mm. I knew diving techniques. I knew all of that. But I had to break it down myself and learn from it, diving forward and just absolutely everything. So that was a very much a self-analysis, self-thought, and just by the experience of doing was the thing that actually allowed me to learn. I think that was a good trait.
To sum up Scotland in the 1980s, I mean, Alex Ferguson was doing his thing with Aberdeen, we should mention, and they won mm-hmm. the league in 84 and 85. Rangers from 1989 onwards did their 9 in a row. Celtic finished second 5 times and, as I mentioned, won the league 4 times in 81, 82, 86 and 88. Was this thoroughly enjoyable in the main? Like, it's a cooker pressure, you've got the Old Firm thing. Does it feel like it feels, we hear it's a bit of a fishbowl at times to live in. In the main, were Celtic supporters happy with how the team were doing across... we're talking about a long time in your case, but say across the 80s. Generally, could you walk through the streets of Glasgow and people were saying, yeah, team's going pretty well, good job, or was it very, very pressurised?
No, I think we were lucky that obviously Jock Stein had left, and Jock Stein left because the team went into a bit of a slump. And that was the pressure that was always under a manager, whether you had to win something almost every single year. Then Billy McNeil took over. John Clark was his assistant. They were the two, obviously, coming out of the Lisbon Lions. There was the natural successors to Jock Stein and Sean Fallon and so on. And right away, they started to recapture the winning streak. You know, they won the cup. They won the league against Rangers 4-2. I was a young boy over at the time. And then suddenly, even in my first 2 years, we won the league back-to-back. Mm. So we were now competing. But I've got to say, guys, and you know, everybody listening and anybody that was around our area, the Scottish game was really, really strong in the 80s. You had ourselves, we had some wonderful players, you know, Roy Aiken, Tommy Burns, Davy Provan, Murray McLeod, Charlie Nicholas, great team. Danny McGrain, who had been out injured and coming back. Maybe the biggest weakness we had was more on the defensive side, because we were an attacking type team. But then when you look at what was up against us, you had Aberdeen under Alec Ferguson, who had wonderful team with players like Willie Miller, Alan McLeish, Jim Layton, you know, Gordon Strachan, you know, Rugby left back, big strong man, Mark McGee coming in up front, you know, really going on winning the Cup Winners' Cup. And then you had Dundee United, who was again another great team under Jim McLean, who was a real tactician, a real tough type manager, with David Neary, Paul Hegarty, Davy Dodds up front, real handful, Paul Sturrock, really good, getting to European finals and semi-finals, and probably very unlucky not to go on, beating Barcelona. Great teams. Rangers were probably the team that wasn't so strong at that particular time, even though we had to go out and beat them in every Old Firm game that we played. So the pressure was more on us. We could have won the league 5 years in a trot, no question about it. We lost a couple of crucial games to allow Dundee United, especially, I think, Dundee United coming down to Celtic Park and playing us in a crucial game near the end, and they beat us. So we could have won it 5 times, but it was a real competitive, but it was such an enjoyable time.
Yeah.
When you're having success, you asked me the question about walking through Glasgow. I've never had any issues walking through Glasgow from anybody. Celtic fans were always supporting you, but if times weren't good in the 90s, which is a little bit more difficult, then you probably were getting a bit of stick. But in the 80s, it was just wonderful. And, you know, we had great players to make it enjoyable inside the dressing room. It was the most enjoyable time I had as a player.
I've seen the Old Firm games from maybe early to mid-90s on, and they look vitriolic. They do nothing for me. I don't like what they represent. What were they like to play in? What were they like in the 80s?
Yeah, it was always, listen, you had to win the game. That was the first thing that was always in your mind. And as a goalkeeper, won the game without making a mistake. that was for sure, to allow the opposition to get the upper hand. So you were always under that bit of pressure going into them. As far as the crowd and all that sort of stuff that went on, we kind of as players switched off from that a little bit. As long as you won the game, then the next 4 or 5 weeks was fine. You could walk around Glasgow, you didn't bother. If you lost the game, then you stayed in your house for a while, just to let things calm down, because you got it from both sides then. But in general, we kind of switched off from it. But you're right to say, listen, it's never been an issue in my family, and my wife's brothers and her dad was a Rangers supporter, season ticket holder. When we married, he came to support me, traveled the world watching Ireland. So our house has been very much, religion. Not all of that doesn't really come into it, whatever side. And I suppose the best way to deal with it is if you, whoever you support, you support and get on with it, as long as you don't bring it home.
So we had Rangers supporting father-in-law, supporting Ireland at World Cups and cheering on Paddy Bonner. That's the way it should be. It's good.
Yeah, well, listen, he was brilliant, because, you know, I suppose he was having a hard time from his fellow Rangers supporters when they realised that I was going out with his daughter and then marrying his daughter. But in general terms, my dad died, as I said earlier, and then he kind of stepped into the breach a little bit to say he was coming to support me, which is a big thing for any man to do, you know.
It's more so then as well, I think, than even now.
Yeah, I think so, absolutely, because that time it wasn't a done thing, you know. And, you know, I remember him sitting up in the stand, he was telling me at Rangers and having the issue that when we were just started to go out together, he couldn't admit to his friends or his people around about him that Paddy Bonner was going out with his daughter. So when every time they were giving me absolute stick up in the stand, he would be standing up for me. But he couldn't admit that I was going out with his daughter, you know. It was only later then. But, you know, listen, he made that big step to come and support me, and he brought my son for years and years and so on. So and as I said, he traveled the world supporting Ireland too in the good times. So I think it was... I look back in it now, and not every man would do it, to be perfectly honest.
No, that's fantastic. We're taking a short break. There's questions coming in from listeners I want to put to you as well. Back in one moment with Paddy Bonner. Loads of texts coming in to say they're enjoying listening to you, Packy, and thanking you for all the years of enjoyment. And great to hear Packy, without question, the man responsible for Ireland's greatest ever sporting moment. It is a mad thing, isn't it, that if we were to have a vote at any stage now, in the previous 30 years or in the next 30 years, what is Ireland's greatest sporting moment? It is you saving that penalty. What a mad thing.
It is.
In the cup final in Scotland before that shootout, I think it finished 9-8. You didn't go the right way once.
Absolutely. I think I was delighted in one way that I shouldn't say that, but Anton Rogan missed a penalty because I was next up to hit a penalty. and not that I was delighted to lose the cup final, but no, I didn't go the right. I went the right way for one penalty, Jim Betts' penalty. And I knew where Jim Betts was putting it because he was a normal penalty taker. And I went the right way. The rest of them, I just couldn't read them at all. You know, Brian Irvine scoring against me, my God, centre half. Alec McLeish scoring against me, putting me the wrong way. I went the wrong way, absolutely, for them all. So I had to learn from that, though. But we sat down. I sat down with Jerry Payton, who was my great comrade and great friend and fellow goalkeeper. And we kind of sat down. Jerry had watched it, and we'd worked out that we needed a new tactic, a new way, a new plan. And that's what we put together for the big moment. Not thinking maybe that it was going to come around in the World Cup, but certainly it did, and I was ready for it.
Mm. And you had been going the right way in the build-up to the Tomofte penalty, so it clearly worked. Yeah. It was effectively the angle of their run-up, that was what you relied on?
Yeah, there was a couple of things. Yeah, you kind of read the situation a bit better. I was on a high going into the penalty shootout because I played quite well in the game. Even though it was 0-0, we had a few saves from Tomofte. I just felt really good and sharp. One of them days, some days you wake up and you know, your legs a bit heavy and so on and so forth, and you're not quite at it. And other days you could take on the world, and that was one of those days. I felt really strong mentally and physically, and then I had prepared properly, and when I went into it, it was just the way that they walked up, the position that they took. I had this idea that, and we'd worked out that if they kind of stood kind of straight on, they were going to either blast or side footed, and if they were going to stand at an acute angle, they would put it back into the side that they were standing on, and that's exactly what happened. Yeah. More or less. I was a bit frustrated in some of the earlier penalties that I touched them and I never made the save, and I thought it was going to run away from us, you know, but when Daniel Tomofte walked up, you could see the nerves in him, you know, as you could see him just walking up to it very slowly. He came on sub during the game, so maybe he hadn't been up to speed, and the angle that he stood at, I was almost telepathic that I was going to go there. It wasn't a great penalty, I've got to say. It wasn't a great pace, and it was about a yard off the ground, and it was the perfect penalty to save. And when you go the right way, and it's not in the corner, it's not really a hard shot, then you have a chance to save it, and that's what happened. But it was a moment. It was a moment that had changed my life. It was a moment that probably people remember to this day, the emotion around it. But what a lovely journey it was during that period, because, you know, it's 30 years now, and people still remember it. And you know, some people came to me years later and said, thanks very much for allowing me to make a connect with my own family, you know. And, you know, people had their barbecues, they had their parties, they had, you know, kids who maybe were 6-7 years old out with their family. It's a bit probably, could I say it, and I hate to say it, maybe even what we're going through now, where people are in the house with their family, and having to do all the different things that they did maybe when they were kids, board games, and just making a connect that they have to make with families. That period was exactly the same, and they all loved it, and they look back to this day and they can remember who they were what. And the moment that the penalty shootout, when I say the penalty, they can describe it as if it was yesterday. And likewise, I feel the same.
And ultimately, the emotion, the connection with people that they felt for others, that's why people remember it so fondly. That's ultimately, when you boil it down, that's what it's about. Am I right in saying when Jack came on board, he pretty much told you he wanted you to marshal that defence? So you talked about it in your book, that you are an introvert, you know, if we were to classify ourselves that bluntly, you're more in the introvert on a scale of the spectrum, but on the pitch that was never the case, and we could see you were very vociferous. But Jack said, I want you marshalling this defence, I want you running things. You had to step up a little bit tactically?
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing I look back on Jack, and nobody ever said to me before that I had to organize things defensively. And Jack says, "You're in charge." He says, "You're in charge of everything." And he says, "If you get it wrong, you're answerable to me." So he, not alone did he give you the responsibility, he put you under pressure. And I've always said that you can hide behind challenges and say no, or you can step up and take them on, and then you're in a better position afterwards. And that's kind of what I felt. It was almost the making of me. It made me a kind of a leader within the team also, because I had to go and tell the people like Liam Brady and Paul McGrath and those Frank Stapleton, those big guys, what they had, the positions that they had take up for corners and free kicks and so on. I did discuss it with Mick McCarthy and Kevin Moore and the other two centre halves, and we worked it out with Jerry Payton before we went out. But it kind of almost had to take on that responsibility. And if it didn't work, then Jack always, you know, said that he would be the one that would make the final decision. But at the end of the day, he didn't have to do that, because I think it worked. We were lucky also that we had such a big team. You know, when you think about it defensively, you had Mick and Kevin, too. You know, Kevin wasn't the tallest, but he was strong physically in the air. Mick was 6'1". I was 6'2". You had Paul McGrath, 6'2". Powerful in the air. Then you had the big guys up front with, you know, Niall Quinn, if he played, 6'5", stick him in the near post, and he covers that whole area. Tony Cascarino, if he played. Steve Staunton was a big lad also when he came into the team, Mark Lawrence. So we had a big, 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 strong team. And if you walked out onto the pitch and you were in the tunnel, yeah, and you were looking at the opposition and you were towering over them, you felt really confident. So you could then organise your team. And we picked up very much zonally. We didn't go man for man. The only person, that really, when we came to Celtic days, Mick McCarthy always wanted to be zonal marking, because he didn't like picking up close to people. And that was a throwback to the Irish team, because he went and attacked an area. So any ball that was played into certain areas, we knew that we had a physical commanding person within that area. So it was easy for me. Free kicks was something that I had to do anyway, even from my early days at Celtic. You had to go and organise walls and so on. So, but what we're saying here is I grew within the team. I grew within, I became a personality within the team. I became a leader within the team. I was a talker anyway on the pitch. Even back to my KG Rovers days, I was a bit of a talker, an organiser, and that. But I think responsibility for any young man, given it, from a person like Jack Charlton, who had won a World Cup, he always trusts you, and that came across.
I was reading a couple of interviews you did around the time your autobiography came out. I was quite surprised to read that in the build-up to the 94 World Cup, you weren't feeling good in yourself about your game. I saw one of the headlines was, I maybe needed a psychologist at that time. Jerry Payton, as a great confidant, wasn't there. Alan Kelly, younger keeper coming through. You're not going to maybe talk to him about your game in the same way you might with Jerry. That struck me. I mean, not as surprising, I suppose, because we're all human. But you were so experienced. You had a World Cup and a Euros under your belt. It's interesting that in 94, almost, you were not feeling good in yourself as opposed to those earlier experiences. Can you put your finger on it now, Paddy?
Yeah, there was a number of things. One, I think I missed Jerry for sure. When that change comes, you become the main guy. Jerry was older than me, and he was very much like a coach, more so than a backup goalkeeper as such. And he went on to become a very good goalkeeper coach, went to Japan, went to Arsenal, I was there for years and years. And even to sit down and talk to him about certain things like tactical situations and so on. Alan was younger, and we didn't have that same relationship. I probably should have been doing what Jerry was doing for me with Alan. And that probably that did happen as I became the goalkeeper coach. But the other thing, probably you mentioned it already, I was an introvert, and I kind of, when your confidence is down a little bit, you become, you know, the introverted type of person you are.
More withdrawn almost.
Yeah, just to fix your confidence a little bit, you know, you're not unsure of yourself slightly. So that was one thing. And then the third thing would have been when we trained, we were in Orlando as a build-up. And Orlando was just an incredible place. It was so, so warm. You know, you went out, if we trained at sort of 11 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, by the time you walked from the pavilion to the training ground, you were absolutely soaking in sweat. you know, all of those type of things. Within 20 minutes, you were absolutely gone. You couldn't do much more. And because we didn't have a goalkeeper coach also, we had to train ourselves. And that was difficult. I had to get in goals and do my bit and then have to take the turn and serve and with Alan. And that was really difficult. So I always had this a thing in my head about preparation, and I was kind of a very organized type person. And I had to work. My mind was that I had to go through my own process. I had to go through a way of working. Probably an hour's work and would be probably what I needed. Then I was lucky if I was doing 20 minutes. Even though I was completely top-level fitness, it just affected that confidence and that thinking upstairs. And I'm sure a lot of professionals, people within any sport can reflect on that also and think about it, that you need a routine, and that routine's broken and broken in a way that you feel that you're just not quite at it. And I think that's probably the biggest thing of all that affected me going into that 94 World Cup.
How quickly do you park the, for instance, the Wim Jonk mistake? Clearly, not something you do routinely, clearly, across this magnificent career you had. And I think Holland would have won that game regardless, is the truth. But how quickly can you park something like that as a goalkeeper? And the other 10 players make numerous mistakes across a game, which we've all forgotten.
Yeah, well, that's the hardest bit for all goalkeepers, is to try to get rid of that mistake as the game, especially if you're in the middle of a game, and that's not easy. That's something you can almost learn how to do over the years. And some young goalkeepers tend that, you know, they can't do that, and they have to find a way of doing it. But for me, I was lucky. Listen, the mistake happened. Even to this day, people never reflect on that. They never talk too much about it. They almost look back to the 90 World Cup and the penalty save and all that, which is nice. I'm not complaining in any way. But it was a big moment, and that really got me down. And it was the last game in the tournament, which probably helped in one way. We were out, we were gone. The holidays were coming in, you had a bit of time to recover, and my international career was winding down, so it wasn't the start of my international career, and all of that helped. I was getting into more coaching at that point in time anyway. I was going back with Tommy Burns after that to Celtic. He had returned and asked me to come back with him continue to play, but more so into the coaching side. So I was kind of coming to the end of my career when that happened. So that helped, to be perfectly honest. But it took me a while, I must admit, to get over it.
Yeah, it is the curse of the goalkeeper, those mistakes, you know, opposed to any other position.
The other point on that is that as a goalkeeper, and all young goalkeepers listening maybe today will reflect on this, that you have to have a middle ground. You can't get too high when things are going well for you, and you can't go too low when you're down there and you're making mistakes. You've got to have that sort of middle ground, and you've got to find a way to sort of get rid of those mistakes. Think about them, learn from them, but actually park them somewhere and then fill the gap with something more positive.
The good news in this interview is it's been thoroughly enjoyable. The bad news is I still wanted to talk to you about everything from the back pass rule going in 92 to your memories of even the 02 World Cup to your work with UEFA now, like the goalkeeping position we could do an hour on and how that's changed there are about five or six other things, but we're not going to have time to do it, which is always a good sign in a way. One thing to finish on, because I did see that the FAI has undergone massive changes, and you would have been involved for a long time, and then things ended and you didn't talk about it for a long time, and there was definitely the sense there was hurt there. Did I see recently you were the guest of the FAI at a game? Has whatever wrongs happened there, have they been made right, or are things better there now, Paddy?
No, listen, I had a wonderful time when I was in the FAI initially. When I went in as technical director, listen, I've continued in football all my life.
Yeah.
And to take on a role within the FAI, a substantial role, I must say. And there were fantastic people there. I had great staff, great friends. I travelled around the whole of Ireland. I went to places that I didn't know existed or didn't probably get the opportunity when I played, or used to go to Donegal all the time, my holidays. So I went to all over Ireland and met brilliant, brilliant people who are really into developing the game. Our big focus at the start was participation, which we did. We had to change the whole coach education pathway, which we did, and just good people around. There was always an issue where you had to discuss with people and try to get them to change. Change is not easy in any shape or form, especially if you've been doing things for 30, 40 years and you've got to now change around a little bit. But it was a concerted effort. It wasn't just myself. We grew our staff from 25 people when I took it over from Brian. And Brian had brought in some great people and had done a really good job. I was very lucky at that point in time that we had gone through a process of developing a technical development plan, which I had to finish off with the great Pat Duffy, who's no longer with us, and Richard Fahey and the rest of the staff. So I had real focus for about 4 or 5 years. Things changed when the stadium came on board and when the whole downturn came. And, you know, people talked to me about John Delaney and so on and so forth. John supported very much at the start of what we were doing, but his focus also changed. And I don't want to go into John too much. He was a difficult guy to get on side and get to work with, but we all know the history of it now without even going into that detail. What's happening now is change, and I just feel that change had to happen. And it had to happen for the right reasons, I just feel that, are we going in the right direction now? Time will tell. I hope we are. I really, really hope we are, because I've always said it, that the FAI doesn't belong to one person. Didn't belong to me when I was there as technical director. Didn't belong to John Delaney, although he probably thought it did in many ways. It belongs to the people of Ireland and the people of, and whoever's the custodians in those positions of control or power or even positions of work, they have to do it for the right reasons. And they have to do it to sustain football in Ireland. I think the great thing out of this whole situation we're going through now has been tough on a lot of families, and, you know, health is a huge issue, but sport also has its place to play in Ireland, and people now would love us to be back and on all sports participating for the young people and so on. So whoever's running the FAI, Niall, the board, they've got to do the right thing and do it for the right reasons, not for themselves or for anything else. That's the key for me.
Well, listen, on that note, thanks so much for giving us the last hour of your time. Like I said, we can do a part two down the line. Loads of things to talk to you about.
Yeah, I'd love to, actually. I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about what I'm doing now. And even get into the FAI stuff and talking about all of that, because it's I'm passionate about it. I'm passionate about sport, great, Ireland and football.
Well, we'll nag you again in a month, and we'll chalk that in, and we'll do something. In the meantime, can I wish you, I think I'm a week early, a happy 60th birthday, which must be a surreal thing. The years are gone by.
The hair's gone very grey now, you see. Nah, you're
aging exceptionally well. Thanks so much, Packy. Loads of great messages in. Tell Packy he was my hero as a boy. I met him in Glasgow a couple of years ago. He was the polite, courteous gent you'd expect your hero to be. Thanks for all the great memories, says Gareth in Armagh. So we'll leave it at that. Packy Bonner, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.